Hi, I'm Pete Hill, and this is the D-Word podcast, where we talk dementia. Now, every year on World Alzheimer's Day, a new World Alzheimer's report is released, and this year's has the central theme of risk reduction. My guest this week is Wendy Weidner from Alzheimer's Disease International, who was one of the authors of the report. Well, Wendy, it's great to welcome you to the D Word. Lots to talk about with the World Alzheimer's Report 2023. But before we get into that, why don't you just tell us a little bit about Alzheimer's Disease International and your role there?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Pete, for inviting me to talk about ADI and the report. I mean, it's something that's been a big part of my life over the last 6 months, writing that report, I tell you. But just to give you a little bit more about ADI, so we're the Global Federation of Alzheimer Associations, and we have 105 members all over the world. And so it really, we've been around since 1984, and we were founded by the four big Alzheimer associations. So it was Canada, US, Australia, and the UK. And so the idea was, they recognized, as big organizations working in the field of Alzheimer's and dementia, that they needed an organization to represent them globally, and especially at the UN and at WHO, to really advocate on a global basis. So they created ADI, and we used to be based in the US, but then moved over to the UK, where we're based now. But we, like I said, we have these 105 members, and they vary from these high income countries, like I said, to all the way through to middle and lower income countries, you know, the global south. And really our role is to work globally to advocate around keeping dementia as a global health priority, and ensuring that we encourage governments to take up the Global Action Plan on Dementia, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But also to really challenge stigma on a global basis, because this is a huge issue everywhere. And also to encourage research, looking at how we can get research into a cure and a disease-modifying treatment, but equally research into good care for people that are living with dementia now. So we work on a regional and a global basis with regional bodies like you know, PAHO and APRO and AFRO, the WHO regional bodies, but equally with WHO and the UN. So that's a little bit about ADI. My role.
Yeah.
So I'm the head of research and publications. So I straddle those both of those areas, which is quite interesting, because a lot of the work that we do in research is in collaboration with research institutes and universities, always on a global basis. And our view is really, when we do research, we want to build capacity of our members. So it's not just about zeroing in on one specific area. We like to build capacity as well. And that really feeds into the publications work that we do. And we've got two major publications that we do at ADI. One is comes out in every May, and we launch it at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, and it's called From Plan to Impact. And this looks at how many, it's sort of a tally of how many national dementia plans there are, and what areas they're focusing on. And we get information on this from our members. Our members really feed into us, telling us, you know, how they're doing in their own countries, how they're advocating in governments in their own countries. And we're the only organization that's keeping track of how many national plans there are. But equally, in that publication, we try to shine a light on good practice and what's happening around the globe in different national plans, and what different non-governmental organizations are doing, and different research projects that are doing a really good job in all across the globe. And then, of course, we also do the World Alzheimer Report, which is launched every year on World Alzheimer's Day. And that is a different subject every year. And I'm sure we'll talk about that very soon, but this year was on risk reduction. Very interesting subject.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a very interesting report. Before we get into the contents, I just want to congratulate you because I read a lot of reports and I did in my previous career. And I've got to be frank with you, a lot of them, it's really hard going to get beyond the introduction because they kind of strike you as expert reports written for experts. And they were somewhat inaccessible. Whereas actually, I sat down yesterday and read this one and I thought, it's almost like a book. This is readable, and to do that with a complex subject like dementia, you know, that must have been a really a hard task to make it eminently accessible.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad to get that feedback because that's exactly what we wanted to do. We felt, you know, that this idea about risk reduction, you know, dementia is such a complex issue, and it's such a complex issue for each individual, but on a global basis it is. And you know, I think there's been a lot of interest recently because there are these possible disease-modifying drugs that are coming out, but not everyone is going to have access to that. It's not the appropriate treatment for everybody anyway, because there are many different types of dementia, not just Alzheimer's, as you know. And so, we really felt that actually risk reduction is the one area that anybody can do something about. You know, it's the thing that we can all do. And if that's the case, then we wanted to make the report as accessible as possible. We wanted anyone to be able to pick it up and to be able to pull something out of it, you know, to extract any information that they could. So we wanted to make it accessible and interesting. And we wanted to get the voices of different people in that report. So we wanted to make sure that we had regional representation and not just this sort of voice of ADI telling you what to do. You know, we didn't want it to be like that at all. So, and that's why we decided that we wanted to have a journalistic voice in it, because we think that that's quite easy to read, and somebody who would actually be inquisitive and question things and really unpick the issue and make it, really investigate it, but equally lay it out in a way that would make sense. And so that's why we ended up commissioning Simon Long from The Economist to help us do that piece. And he was amazing. He spoke to over 90 different specialists across the globe to really lay out what you see in that report. And there's a lot of extra stuff that never got into the report just because we wanted to keep it we didn't want it to be too long. We wanted it to be something that you could sit down and read all in one go if you wanted to, or just pick little pieces out as you went along. And equally, the nice thing about the report is that we commissioned journalists from different regions as well to tell the story in their region, what's happening in South America, what people are doing in South Africa, you know, what people are doing in these blue zones in Japan, you know, how do people live longer? How are they living differently than the rest of us? We looked at also groups that don't always get access to care in the same way. So the LGBTQI+ groups of people, there's a lovely story on that as well. So yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And, you know, hopefully picked out some ideas of, you know, how you can change. I certainly did when I was reading through it myself.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
This is the D Word Podcast, and I'm chatting to my guest, Wendy Widener from Alzheimer's Disease International, about the brand new World Alzheimer's Report. I mean, you've got six major chapters in there, all looking at risk reduction. Physical health is the first one. And one thing that always has kind of got me before I read the report about physical health is that over the years, we've got fairly well versed with the things like diet in respect of heart health and exercise in respect of heart health. But this whole concept of diet and exercise for brain health seems to be one that's passed everybody by, and you don't kind of see people asking questions about that.
Yeah, it's true. And I think, you know, our one of the things I think we're learning is how connected our whole system is, each of us, you know, the how our bodies work and how our gut is connected to our brain, and our cardiovascular system has such a huge impact. And I think that's why, you know, what's good for your heart is good for your brain. That is a great slogan, and it's true. You know, it is true. But there are all sorts of things, as we mentioned in the report, that are not connected to cardiovascular health that impact your brain as well, you know. And so that's why it's so important to look at all of those physical characteristics. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that came out was how the role of ultra-processed foods and how this has impacted so many different populations, how it's impacted our heart health, like you say, our obesity and diabetes risk, which is also a risk factor for dementia, our gut health, and how this impacts our brain health. That for me was quite interesting. And, you know, I think one of the things we tried to do, and this is why the Pilchard article was so important, is that we didn't want to say, this is the diet you have to take, because, you know, we know that there's been a lot of research on the MIND diet and on the DASH diet, but not everybody can access that and not everybody can afford that. And that's why we tried to say in the report, our recommendation was really eating as healthy as you can. And if there's local food that is healthy, like Pilchard's, that's affordable, then by all means, use that in your diet and try to create that healthy diet within locally produced vegetables. And just having a well-balanced diet is quite important. And another thing that came out, I don't know if you noticed this, I mean, certainly for myself, I was quite taken by the impact of hearing loss as a physical risk, and how important it is if you are experiencing hearing loss to get yourself tested and get a hearing aid. And that can have a huge impact on reducing your risk of cognitive decline. It's certainly something I have looked at. There's a new app that I found from that WHO has put out. It's called Hear Who. And you can download it on your phone and you can test your hearing, and it'll give it's you just all you have to have are earplugs, and you can it's a simple test that you can take, and it will give you a rating, so you can actually follow your own progress. And if you get to a point where you need to go in, you can have your hearing tested then. So that's a plug for that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a very interesting subject. A couple of weeks ago, I had an audiologist on the show, and we were talking exactly that. And, you know, it taught me a whole lot. The other thing I like about the layout in the report is while you've got headings for the chapters, they're not exclusive headings, so it's not all in chunks. And you notice that physical health runs into brain health, which runs into population level and various other things. And I think it gives you the real feeling that, as you said at the beginning, this is all joined together. You can't just take one piece out of it and deal with that. It's a real jigsaw. You need to put it all together.
Yes, that's right. And it's interesting because we have in the report, we talk about the fingers study that's being done globally. And that's quite interesting. But the interesting point that's made there is there's a nice little infographic of the hand, you know, the five areas that you can use to reduce your risk. And I was just at a conference, the Alzheimer Europe conference this past week, where Mia Kivipelto, who's the who leads on the fingers work, was talking about some of the results that they've had over the years through these over these 60 different projects that they've got globally. And that they're finding that, you know, often people that take part in these studies or, you know, and you think I've got to do all five things all the time, every day. I've got to have cognitive stimulation. I've got to do the diet right. I've got to exercise. I've got to watch my heart health, and I've got to, you know, socialize with people. And so you have these five things you've got to do. And basically what she said is, if you just do some of them every day, you know, you even that reduces your risk, you know, doing a little bit every day helps. And I think that's also what we were trying to get across on the, in the report, that, you know, sometimes it can feel kind of overwhelming, trying to be good all of the time. And sometimes you can't be good all the time. Sometimes you are going to have a lazy day where you don't exercise, or maybe you will have extra chocolate or something. But, you know, that actually it's the long game. It's the long game that you look at and how you try to change some of your behaviors. That's the best thing.
I mean, one of the other things, kind of previous career, I dealt with line air pollution. So I was very interested in obviously the effects of air pollution, very small particles, PM2.5s. And that again, you know, I had someone on the show probably 6 months ago talk about that. And I think, I still think people don't quite make that link because air pollution very much is thought of as, cardiovascular, COPD, breathlessness, lungs, etc. But you know, there is real increasing evidence now that it's a big problem in terms of dementia.
Yeah, and this whole sort of it's interesting. I just heard a lecture on this when I was at the conference about this connection between the olfactory, so your nose, the nose to brain, and you know, how your brain will absorb some of these pollutants and the impact that it will have on a cellular level. So it's quite interesting. And here, this is where we jump into that sort of population based responsibility, you know, that governments need to take this into account. You know, they have to be held to account, really, when we think about air pollution. And it's a huge problem. And not, it's not just a problem in big cities, you know, because pollution is also things that go into our groundwater. There's all sorts of other, you know, just even traffic and those particles, as you say, you know, so we have to really, this is one of the areas that governments have to be held accountable for. And equally thinking about creating green spaces, more green spaces for people to exercise that are safe places for people to exercise, and facilitating that, you know. This is another thing. What, something that came out as quite interesting, that a discussion that was in that population-based section was looking at, sometimes it's hard for governments to take on big issues like that, but one area that governments can, almost like a bridge between personal risk reduction levels and population-based, is this idea of the role of community programs and how they are almost a bridge between those two. Because if governments can invest in community-based programs, then people can maybe have, you know, Tai Chi exercises in a park, or, you know, running groups that they get together and do, or even social things like, you know, choirs, which are also risk reduction, you know, being part of groups where there's music and singing and dancing. And so if these kind of groups can thrive, that's risk reduction as well. So that is almost that, like I said, that bridge between the sort of personal responsibility and the government responsibility.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I think the other thing that came out is how current some of the issues are, because there was a bit in there about social isolation, which is, we know is an issue. And we've just gone through a global pandemic where social isolation has been required at times, to keep us safe, and the real effects of that. And the other one that I saw, just kind of leaping subjects, was staying with the air pollution, the effects of global warming and the number of forest fires that we are now having. And also the effect of breathing in that pollution. So, you know, I think it's very good, sort of finger on the pulse stuff to keep all this current and be able to join all those dots together.
Yeah, you're right, because there's so much happening globally right now that will impact us in so many ways, you know, and the role of climate change is huge. You know, your example of the forest fires is excellent. I mean, you know, we all experienced that this year, didn't we? When you think about the number of countries that had terrible fires and cities that showed, you know, turning completely orange, and you think people having to stay inside because of the smoke that they were inhaling, and you know, these kind of changes are accelerating, and so you know, we need to be mindful of how all of this impacts our health, and especially our brain health. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, again, it's, I think we could talk for days actually on parts of the report, because there is so much stuff in there. Preventative risk reduction, identifying those at higher risk and early diagnosis is the key, as I see it anyway. There is new technology, non-invasive technology, which can start looking at diagnosis. And there was the sentence in there that I loved was that at the moment, we're not proactively looking at the problem. We're waiting for it to come to us, which, you know, that's a real turn around in the way you look at things and think, well, you know, we should proactively be dealing with this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's something that is coming up quite a bit more, and that's people taking a lifelong approach to it. And so, I mean, I think there are some people out there that might not be making that decision to see whether or not you have a genetic higher risk factor is a very personal one. And so everybody has to make that one on their own, I think. And there are advantages to that, because you can start risk reduction a lot earlier. I mean, there are some people that think, well, we should all be doing it anyway. And that's one of the things I really liked was some of the programs that were highlighted that go into schools and talk to young people about, you know, starting good practices at a very young age and sort of changing how we talk about brain health and the positives around that. So young people, and certainly there's a discussion about people in their 20s, the younger groups from 20s to 40s, who were saying, you know, actually they want to be much more proactive about the choices that they're making around their diet, their exercise, how much alcohol they drink, et cetera. The changes that people make early on, I think, are lifelong good choices, you know. But equally, as new treatments come into the fore, I think people are going to possibly, once these blood biomarker tests digital biomarkers become more readily available, it'll be easier for people to see whether they are at risk and whether they can either access treatment or continue on their risk reduction behaviors. But, you know, it's certainly something that we don't have to wait for. We can just do that. We can just start it.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
If you'd like to contact us here on the podcast, love to hear from you. We're on email at tdwradio@gmail.com, or we're on all the socials as Radio TDW, X, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Back to my guest now, Wendy Weidner from Alzheimer's Disease International. Very, very wrongly, people get written off after they have a diagnosis. Whereas, you know, it was nice to see a friend of mine mentioned in there, Kevin Quaid.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin is You know, it also said there, the show of a strong personality. Well, if you want a strong personality, then Kevin, he's an absolutely great guy. But it's important to me that there are things you can do, even after a diagnosis. Hey, let's not write anybody off here.
Yeah, it's so true. I think, you know, the number of people that have said they've just been given their diagnosis and then told to go home and put their life in order, you know, that those days are changing, I think. You know, it's people are, you know, now we're realizing that actually you can live a long time with dementia and that you can live well for a long time and that actually you can still learn. You can still learn to do things. It was interesting. I was in a, just because I've just come back from this conference, I heard a lot of new discussions and there was a gentleman that was talking about getting his diagnosis and he had to stop working at a bank. But he thought, you know, okay, I'm going to take classical guitar lessons. And so he then learned how to play classical guitar, learned a whole new skill. And, you know, I think the underlying thing that came out for me in that chapter is maintaining your sense of purpose in life. That is so important. And, you know, for a lot of people that talked in that chapter, it wasn't only the things that they were doing in terms of how they were changing their diet or, you know, I think Lori Waters was saying, well, I let myself have a steak, but only once every 2 weeks. You know, she gave herself that as a treat. But a lot of them talked about their advocacy work and the almost mentoring work that they're doing with each other and that giving them this purpose, keeping them engaged, I think is so important. And I think we underestimate that. You know, we can't write, like you say, we can't write off people just because they have a diagnosis. There's still so much people can do. And Kevin's a perfect example of that. You know, he continues his advocacy work. He's written a number of books. You know, he's taking a big bite out of life still, you know, and that's amazing. So,
yeah, I think it's, you know, I had Agnes Houston on the show a few weeks ago. And again, she's an unbelievable example of someone who, you know, maintains a great sense of humor. She's a brilliant advocate. And I think that really is so important, as you say, that sense of purpose. Come to the big bit, which are the conclusions at the end and the recommendations. Talked about governments kind of, you know, a little bit through the conversation. I mean, dealing with all the governments in the world, which is, you know, a real mammoth task, how do you get people to really take notice when, you know, we know we've got so much going on in the world? You know, how do you get this into the, you know, the top of the league in terms of things that governments have got to deal with?
Well, I think the thing that we keep talking about is there's a couple of things. One is that, you know, we know that numbers of people living with dementia is on the increase. You know, we know that there are currently over 50 million and that, you know, in 2050, there are going to be, you know, over 139 million. So we know those numbers are going up. And we also know that they're going up, they're going to be going up more in the global South, actually. And that is a pandemic in itself. If you think about it, you know, it's huge. And so that's going to cost governments a lot of money. So they need to think about what's the sort of what's ahead of them. And equally, they, you know, all member states and WHO committed in 2017, they unanimously committed to this global action plan on dementia. And they said, you know, look, we say that 75% of us are going to have a national dementia plan that's going to sort of plan in each of our countries how we're going to focus on, you know, getting people a timely diagnosis and getting them treatment and care, and a pathway that they can follow when, if and when they receive a diagnosis. So they've committed to that, you know, so that's an obligation. That's why we have the From Plan to Impact report that I mentioned earlier that sort of keeps track. And if people, governments do not have a plan, because we have relations with WHO, we can actually, as an organization, write directly as a non-state actor, we can write directly to governments and say, you know, look, you have this many people living with dementia in your country right now. It's expected to go up this much. what are you going to do about it? You've got to, you know, where is your plan? So we have to, as an advocacy organization, we need to keep that pressure up. But equally, there is evidence that when you put these risk reduction behaviors and practices in place, incidence and prevalence of dementia starts to decrease. And this is what we've seen in places like the US and the UK, that some of these measures can actually start to decrease dementia, risks of dementia. It's like, I think we have an example in the report about when they did the work with taking salt out of the diet and how that brought blood pressure down, and blood pressure then has an impact on cardiovascular. So, I mean, these things are sort of cost-effective ways that you can actually start to reduce some of the risk. And then that has a snowball effect, doesn't it? If you have fewer people developing these conditions, you have less pressure on health systems, et cetera. So we sort of try to advocate as responsibility with if governments have made this commitment, equally that it's a cost-effective way for governments to plan out how they're going to, you know, keep their populations healthier. So
I guess there are so many commonalities as well, that there are payoffs in other areas, because not only reducing dementia risk, you're reducing cardiovascular risk, you're reducing obesity, etc. So it is a whole thing to surely sit there and say, well, it's not only us that's saying this, it's all these people over here as well.
Exactly. We've seen through some of the studies that have been done that, just as you say, when you put these risk reduction efforts in place for individuals, it reduces their risk for all sorts of chronic disease, not just dementia, you know? It's overall a very good choice for governments. And this is why we also made a call in the recommendations that, you know, they should really have robust risk reduction parts of their national plans, because it's such a low-hanging fruit, really, for a government to put into a plan. Because, you know, there are seven key action areas that WHO recommends that they put in a national plan. So things like getting people access to a good diagnosis and access to good post-diagnostic care and raising awareness and challenging stigma and research and support for carers. But risk reduction is one of those areas, and it's something that's, like we've been saying, could be quite cost effective. And so it's a good thing to put in your national plan.
Well, unfortunately, Wendy, time's bringing us to a bit of a close. Like I said, we could talk all day, and I think we're going to have to get you back on the show to talk a little more. Congratulations on the report. As I said earlier, I think it's great. I think everybody should read it. It's very accessible. And just thank you so much for talking about it and being my guest here.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure. And like you said, we could have talked for another few hours, I'm sure. And maybe we'll have to come back and talk again. Because can I just also tell you that next year, the World Alzheimer Report is going to be on stigma. And so we did a report on stigma in 2019, where we did a global report. We interviewed almost 70,000 people globally to find out what was the sort of baseline, how much stigma is there out there? And we found some incredible information about how, you know, a third of people think that dementia is a normal part of aging, and, you know, 62% of people that are healthcare professionals think that it's a normal part of aging. Well, those are shocking statistics. We're going to do another one. We're going to do a follow-on next year. So there's going to be a survey coming out very soon, and we'd love as many people to fill it out as possible. We want the general public to fill it out. We want healthcare professionals and people living with dementia and their carers. So, so watch for that link. I'll send it to you.
Please do. Yeah. You know, we'll do our best to spread the word on that, most definitely. And, you know, when the report comes out, hopefully we can get back together and chat about it. Thanks, Wendy.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Many thanks to Wendy, and hopefully we can get her back on the podcast next year. The World Alzheimer's Report 2023 is free to download from the Alzheimer's Disease International website at www.alzint.org. Well, that's it for another edition. Thanks for your company. Hope you've enjoyed it. And you'll join me again soon for another D-Word podcast.